The experience of growing up in what wasn't yet even called Silicon Valley in the late 1960s and early 1970s was unique. The environs between Palo Alto and San Jose were a boom town of a new kind, attracting highly educated electrical engineers, chemists, optical specialists, computer programmers, and physicists who were drawn to the region's blossoming semiconductor, telecommunications, and electronics companies. It was a time when the market for high-end electronics had shifted from government and military customers to corporate and industrial America, expanding dramatically the number of potential customers for new electronic technologies of all kinds. The fathers of many other kids in Steve's neighborhood were engineers who commuted to work at the nearby headquarters of emerging tech giants like Lockheed, Intel, Hewlett-Packard, and Applied Materials. Living there, a curious child interested in math and science could easily develop a much deeper sense of the leading edge of technology than those growing up elsewhere in the country. Electronics were just beginning to replace hot rods as the passion of young tinkerers. Geeks lived and breathed the fumes emanating from their soldering irons and traded dog-eared copies of Popular Science and Popular Electronics magazines. They built their own transistor radios, hi-fi stereo systems, ham radios, oscilloscopes, rockets, lasers, and Tesla coils from kits offered by mail-order companies like Edmund Scientific, Heathkit, Estes Industries, and Radio Shack. In Silicon Valley, electronics wasn't just a hobby. It was a fast-growing new industry and just as exciting as rock and roll. For precocious kids like Steve, the implicit promise in all this was that anything could be figured out. And since anything could be figured out, anything could be built. It gave one the sense that one could build the things that one saw around oneself in the universe, he once told me. These things were not mysteries anymore. You looked at a television set and you would think that, I haven't built one of those, but I could. There's one of those in the Heathkit catalog, and I built two other Heathkits, so I could build that. Things became much more clear that they were the results of human creation, not these magical things that just appeared in one's environment, and that one had no knowledge of their interiors. He joined the Explorers Club, a group of 15 kids who met regularly on Hewlett-Packard's campus in Palo Alto to work on electronics projects and get lessons from HP engineers. This is where Steve was first exposed to computers. It's also what gave him the outlandish notion to reach out and establish a minor but fascinating connection with one of the two men who famously created HP, the first Silicon Valley dynamo out of a garage. When he was 14 years old, he called up Bill Hewlett at his Palo Alto home to ask personally for some hard-to-find electronic components for an Explorers Club project. He got them in part because he already could spin a good tale. In many ways, Steve was a prototypical adolescent geek. But he also was a curious student of the humanities, beguiled by the words of Shakespeare, Melville, and Bob Dylan. Glib and persuasive with his parents, he applied the same skills when dealing with friends, teachers, mentors, and eventually the rich and powerful. Steve innately understood from an early age that the right words and stories could help him win the attention he needed to get what he wanted. Steve was not really a star in this local crowd of budding technologists. But in 1969, a friend named Bill Fernandez introduced him to someone who was, Stephen Wozniak. Stephen Wozniak from nearby Sunnyvale. The son of a Lockheed engineer, Woz was an engineering genius. Steve, it turned out, was a great enabler of genius. This would turn out to be the first great collaboration of his career. Nerdy and shy, Woz was 5 years older, yet far less assertive than Steve. Like Steve, he had learned about electronics from his father and from other neighborhood dads. But he had immersed himself much more deeply into the subject, in school and out, and had even created a rudimentary calculator made of transistors, resistors, and diodes, when he was just entering his teens. In 1971, before the single-chip microprocessor had been commercialized, Woz designed a circuit board loaded with chips and electronic components that he called the cream soda computer, since that was his favorite sugary soft drink at the time. Woz turned himself into an extraordinarily talented hardware designer whose uncanny electronic engineering instincts were coupled with a great software programmer's imagination. He could see shortcuts, both in circuits and in software, that others simply couldn't envision. Steve didn't have Woz's innate talent, but he did have a native hunger to put really cool stuff into the hands of as many people as possible. This unique trait fundamentally separated him from other hobbyists messing around with computers. From the start, he had the natural inclination to be an impresario, to convince people to pursue a goal that often only he could see, and then to coordinate and push them toward the creation of that goal. The first sign of that came in 1972, when he and Woz started in on an unlikely commercial collaboration. With Steve's help, Woz developed the first digital blue box, a machine that could mimic the tones used by telephone company switches to connect specific phones anywhere in the world. A prankster could hold one of these clever and illegal battery-powered gadgets up to the mouthpiece of any telephone and fool Ma Bell's switching systems into making long-distance or even international calls for free. Woz would have been happy to just build the circuit and share it, as would be his inclination later with the circuit board that formed the heart and soul of the Apple I computer. Steve, however, proposed that they try to make some money by selling completely assembled machines. So, while Woz polished his circuit design, Steve pulled together the necessary materials and priced the finished boxes. He and Woz netted some $6,000 selling the illegal devices at $150 a pop, mostly to college students. The two boys would wander dormitory hallways, knocking on doors and asking the occupants if this was George's room, a fictional George who supposedly was an expert phone freak. If the discussion prompted interest, they'd demonstrate what the blue box could do, and sometimes make a sale. But business was spotty, and when they went further afield, the venture foundered. The boys closed up shop after one supposed customer pulled a gun on Steve. Still, it wasn't bad for a first effort. It may seem strange to include Steve's spiritual life as one of the source materials of his career. But as a young man, Steve, with great sincerity, sought a deeper reality, a plane of consciousness beneath the surface. He pursued it with psychedelic drugs, and he pursued it with religious exploration. This spiritual sensibility contributed greatly to the unusual breadth of his intellectual peripheral vision, which eventually led him to see possibilities, ranging from great new products to radically reinvented business models that escaped most others. Just as Silicon Valley was the environment that birthed and nurtured Steve's technological optimism, the 1960s was the decade that fueled an inquisitive teen's natural impulse to search for deeper truths. Like so many other young people of the time, Steve embraced the questioning and yearning of the counterculture movement. He was a baby boomer who experimented with drugs, drank deeply of the insurgent lyrics of musicians like Dylan, the Beatles, the Grateful Dead, the Band, and Janis Joplin, even the radical, more abstract sonic musings of Miles Davis, and delved into the works of people he considered philosopher kings, spiritual thinkers like Suzuki Roshi, Ram Dass, and Paramahansa Yogananda. The messages of the time were clear. Question everything, especially authority. Experiment. Hit the road. Be fearless. And work to create a better world. Steve's own grand quest began immediately after graduating from Cupertino's Homestead High School, when he headed off to Reed College in Portland, Oregon. It didn't take long before the headstrong freshman was only attending the classes that fascinated him, and after just one semester, he abruptly dropped out, without even telling his parents. he spent a second semester auditing classes, including one calligraphy course that he would cite in later years as the inspiration for the Macintosh's ability to produce a diverse panoply of typographical fonts. He also delved more deeply into Asian philosophy and mysticism, and dropped acid with greater frequency, at times almost as a spiritual sacrament. The next summer, after returning flat broke to live with his parents again in Cupertino, he spent considerable time commuting back and forth to work at an Oregon apple orchard that doubled as a sort of commune. Eventually, he landed a job back home as a technician at Atari, the video game company started by Nolan Bushnell, the inventor of Pong. He proved adept at repairing game machines that had gone on the fritz, and was able to convince Bushnell to let him fix some coin-operated kiosks in Germany, as part of a deal to pay his way to India, where he would join his pal Robert Friedland, the charismatic owner of that Oregon orchard. It was all part of a romantic search for a way of life that had real meaning, at a time when the culture smiled on such quests. "You've got to keep Steve in the context of the time," says Larry Brilliant. "What were we all looking for? There was a generational split then, a split that was far deeper than the left-right split we have now, or the fundamentalist-secular split. And even though Steve had wonderfully supportive adoptive parents, he would get letters from Robert Friedland and other people who were in India, who had gone there seeking peace and believed they'd found something. That was what Steve was looking for. Steve ostensibly went to India hoping to meet Neem Karoli Baba, known as Maharaji, the famous guru, who was an inspiration to Brilliant, Friedman, and other seekers. But Maharaji died shortly before Steve's arrival, to his lasting disappointment. Steve's time in India was splintered, as unfocused as the searches of many young people seeking a broader vision than the one they were handed as children. He went to a religious festival attended by 10 million other pilgrims. He wore flowing cotton robes, ate strange foods, and had his head shaved by a mysterious guru. He got dysentery. For the first time, he read Yogananda's Autobiography of a Yogi, a book that he would return to several times throughout his life, and that would be given to everyone who attended the reception following Steve's memorial service at Stanford University's Memorial Church on October 16, 2011. Early in his stay, according to Brilliant, Steve had been flirting with the idea of being sadhu. "Most Indian sadhus live a monk-like existence of deprivation as a way of focusing solely on the spiritual. But Steve was obviously too hungry, too driven, and too ambitious for that kind of life. It was a romance," says Brilliant, "with the idea of being a renunciate. But that doesn't mean he came back to the United States disillusioned or that he dismissed Eastern spiritualism altogether. His interests migrated toward Buddhism, which allows for more engagement with the world than is permitted ascetic Hindus. It would enable him to blend a search for personal enlightenment with his ambition to create a company that delivered world-changing products. This appealed to a young man busy trying to invent himself, and it would continue to appeal to a man of infinite intellectual restlessness. Certain elements of Buddhism suited him so well that they would provide a philosophical underpinning for his career choices, as well as a basis for his aesthetic expectations. Among other things, Buddhism made him feel justified in constantly demanding nothing less than what he deemed to be perfection from others, from the products he would create, and from himself. In Buddhist philosophy, life is often compared to an ever-changing river. There's a sense that everything and every individual is ceaselessly in the process of becoming. In this view of the world, achieving perfection is also a continuous process, and a goal that can never be fully attained. That's a vision that would come to suit Steve's exacting nature. Looking ahead to the unmade product, to whatever was around the next corner, and the two or three after that one, came naturally to him. He would never see a limit to possibilities, a perfect endpoint at which his work would be done. And while Steve would eschew almost all self-analysis, the same was true of his own life. Despite the fact that he could be almost unfathomably stubborn and opinionated at times, the man himself was constantly adapting, following his nose, learning, trying out new directions. He was constantly in the act of becoming. None of this was readily apparent to the outside world, and Steve's Buddhism could befuddle even his closest friends and colleagues. "There was always the spiritual side," says Mike Slade, a marketing executive who worked with Steve later in his career, "which really didn't seem to fit with anything else he was doing. He meditated regularly until he and Lorene became parents, when the demands on his time grew in a way he hadn't anticipated. He reread Suzuki's Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind several times, and made the intersection of elements of Asian spiritualism and his business and commercial life a regular subject of the conversations he and Brilliant enjoyed throughout his life. For years, he arranged for a Buddhist monk by the name of Kobun Chino Otagawa to meet with him once a week at his office to counsel him on how to balance his spiritual sense with his business goals. While nobody who knew him well during his later years would have called Steve a devout Buddhist, the spiritual discipline informed his life in both subtle and profound ways. When Steve returned to America in the fall of 1974, he landed back at Atari, mainly doing hardware-related troubleshooting tasks for Nolan Bushnell's pioneering and poorly managed company. Atari was such a loose, strange organization that Jobs could still comfortably disappear for a couple of weeks to pick apples at Robert Friedland's orchard and not get fired. Or even be missed, really. Meanwhile, Woz was working at Hewlett-Packard in a safe, well-paying but not particularly challenging gig. Nothing about Jobs' life at this time would have suggested that he would achieve extraordinary success in business, computer technology, or anything else for that matter. But unbeknownst, even to himself, Steve was about to begin the real work of creating his life. In the next 3 years, he would morph from a scruffy, drifting 19-year-old into the co-founder and leader of a revolutionary new American business. Steve was blessed to live at a moment that was ripe and ready for someone with his talents. It was an era of change on so many fronts, and especially in the world of information technology. In the 1970s, big machines called mainframes defined computing. Mainframes were enormous room-sized computing systems sold to customers like airlines, banks, insurers, and large universities. The programming required to get a result, say to calculate a mortgage payment, was beyond cumbersome. At least it seemed that way for anyone studying computer science in college, which is where most of us had our introduction to making a mainframe actually do something. After settling on the problem you wanted the machine to solve, you would painstakingly write down, in a programming language like COBOL, or Fortran, a series of line-by-line, step-by-step instructions for the exact logical process of the calculation or analytical chore. Then, at a noisy mechanical console, you would type each individual line of the handwritten program onto its own rectangular punch card, which was perforated in such a way that a computer could read it. After meticulously making sure the typed cards were arranged in the right order, simple programs might need a few dozen cards that could be held by a rubber band, while elaborate programs could require reams that would have to be stacked carefully in a special cardboard box. You would then hand the bundle to a computer operator who would put your deck in the queue behind dozens of others to be fed into the mainframe. Eventually, the machine would spit out your results on broad sheets of green and white striped accordion-folded paper. More often than not, you would have to tweak your program 3, 4, or even dozens of times to get the results you were looking for. In other words, computing in 1975 was anything but personal. Writing software was a laborious and slow process. The big, expensive, high-maintenance computers were manufactured and sold, appropriately enough, by a handful of big, bureaucratic technology companies. As it had been since the 1950s, the computer industry in 1975 was dominated by international business machines, IBM, which sold more mainframes than all of its other competitors put together. In the 1960s, those also-rans were called the Seven Dwarfs. But during the 1970s, both General Electric and RCA gave up, leaving a stubborn group of manufacturers referred to as the Bunch, an acronym for Burroughs, Univac, NCR, Control Data Corporation, and Honeywell. Digital Equipment Corporation, DEC, DEC, dominated an upcoming segment of somewhat cheaper and less powerful mini-computers used by smaller businesses and by departments within larger corporations. There was one outlier at each end of the cost spectrum. At the high end, Cray Research, founded in 1972, sold so-called supercomputers used primarily for scientific research and mathematical modeling. These were the most expensive computers of all, costing well north of $3 million. On the cheap end of the scale was Wang, which was founded in the early 1970s and made a task-specific machine known as a word processor. It was the closest thing to a personal computer that existed, since it was designed for a single person to use in the preparation of written reports and correspondence. The computer industry then was primarily an Eastern establishment. IBM was headquartered in the bucolic suburbs north of New York City. DEC and Wang were based in Boston. Burroughs was headquartered in Detroit, Univac in Philadelphia, NCR in Dayton, Ohio, and Cray, Honeywell, and Control Data all hailed from Minneapolis. The only notable early computer maker in Silicon Valley was Hewlett-Packard, but its primary business was making scientific test and measurement instruments and calculators. This industry bore little resemblance to today's entrepreneurial, innovative, and rapidly iterative tech world. It was a stodgy enterprise, most similar to the capital equipment business. Its universe of potential customers could be counted in the hundreds, and these were companies with deep pockets, whose demands focused more on performance and reliability than on price. No surprise, then, that the industry had become cloistered and a little complacent. Out in California, a significant number of the people who would have a hand in flipping that industry on its head started meeting regularly as a hobbyist group called the Homebrew Computer Club. Their first get-together occurred shortly after the publication of the January 1975 issue of Popular Electronics, which featured a cover story about the Altair 8800 microcomputer. Gordon French, a Silicon Valley engineer, hosted the gathering in his garage to show off an Altair unit that French and a buddy had assembled from the $495 kit sold by Micro Instrumentation and Telemetry Systems, MITS. It was an inscrutable-looking device, about the size of a stereo component amplifier, its face sporting two horizontal arrays of toggle switches and a lot of blinking red lights. The clunky thing couldn't do too much, but it demonstrated the feasibility of having a computer to yourself. One that you could program 24 hours a day if you wanted to, without having to wait in line or punch any cards. Bill Gates read the article and shortly thereafter famously dropped out of Harvard to start a little outfit called Microsoft to design software programming languages for the Altair. Woz knew the MITS machine wasn't all that much more advanced than the cream soda computer he'd created 4 years earlier, in 1971. When he had to use much less sophisticated components. Spurred by a geek's natural competitive instincts, he roughed out some new designs for what he knew would be a better microcomputer, one that would be easier to program, control, and manipulate. Flipping toggle switches and counting flashing lights was like using flag semaphore and Morse code, he thought. Why not input commands and data values more directly with a typewriter keyboard? And why not have the computer project your typing and results onto an attached television monitor? And for that matter, why not plug in a cassette tape recorder to store programs and data? The Altair had none of these features that would make computing far less intimidating and far more approachable. This was the challenge Woz decided to tackle. In the back of his mind, he hoped that his employer, HP, might want to manufacture a version of his concept. Enter Steve Jobs, the budding opportunist and junior impresario. He didn't think Woz needed HP. He thought he and Woz could develop a business of their own. Steve knew that Woz was so uniquely talented that any computer he would design would be cheap, usable, and easy to program, so much so that the other hobbyists at Homebrew might want one too. So during the fall and winter of 1975 and early 1976, as Woz perfected his design, Jobs started to conjure how they might pool their resources to purchase the components they needed to make a working prototype. Every couple of weeks, they would take the latest working version of the computer to the Homebrew meetings to show off a new feature or two to the toughest audience in town. Steve persuaded Woz that they could make the club members their customers by selling them the schematics and perhaps even printed circuit boards. Club members could then buy the chips and other components themselves and assemble them into the guts of their very own working microcomputer. To raise the cash to pay a mutual friend to draw a reference design for the circuit boards, Steve sold his treasured Volkswagen minibus, and Woz unloaded his precious HP 65 programmable calculator. After spending $1,000 on designing the board and contracting to have a few dozen made, Jobs and Wozniak made their money back, and then some, by selling them to fellow Homebrew members for $50 apiece, netting them a nifty $30 for each circuit board. It wasn't much of a business, but it was enough for two young men who were coming to believe that these microcomputers could change everything. "We felt it was going to affect every home in the country," Woz explained years later. "But we felt it for the wrong reasons. We felt that everybody was technical enough to really use it and write their own programs and solve their problems that way." Steve decided that their new company should be called Apple. There are different tales about the origin of the name, but it was a brilliant decision. Years later, Lee Clow, Steve's longtime collaborator on Apple's distinctive brand of advertising, told me, "I honestly believe that his intuition was that they were going to change people's lives by giving them technology they didn't know they needed, that would be different from anything they knew. So they needed something friendly and approachable and likable." He took a page out of Sony's book, because Sony was originally called Tokyo Telecommunications Engineering Corporation, and co-founder Akio Morita said they needed something much more approachable. Indeed, adopting the name Apple foreshadows the expansiveness and originality Steve would bring to the creation of these new machines. It's suggestive of so much: the Garden of Eden and the humanity, both good and bad, resulting from Eve's bite of the fruit from the Tree of Knowledge. Johnny Appleseed, the great sower of plentitude from American myth. The Beatles and their own record label, a connection that would lead to litigation years later. Isaac Newton, the plummeting apple and the spark of an idea. American as apple pie. The legend of William Tell, who saved his own life and that of his son by using his crossbow to pierce an apple perched on the sun's head. Wholesomeness, fecundity, and of course, the natural world. Apple is not a word for geeks, unlike ASUS, Compaq, Control Data, Data General, DEC, IBM, Sperry Rand, Texas Instruments, or Wipro, to mention some less felicitously named computer companies. It hints at a company that would bring, as it eventually did, humanism and creativity to the science and engineering of computers. As Clow suggests, settling on Apple was a great intuitive decision. Steve was innately comfortable trusting his gut. It's a characteristic of the best entrepreneurs, a necessity for anyone who wants to make a living developing things no one has ever quite imagined before. Of course, Steve's gut could also betray him, as it did when he fell in love with Apple's first corporate logo. It was a pen and ink drawing, detailed in the way of an etching, of Isaac Newton sitting beneath an apple tree. It was the kind of overworked, precious image that a young calligraphy student might find enchanting, but far too esoteric for a company with big mainstream ambitions. This graphic rendition was drawn by Ronald Wayne, a former Atari engineer whom Steve had recruited to join the team. Wayne would have acted as the wise elder tiebreaker if Steve and Woz ever came to loggerheads. The three signed a partnership agreement that gave Steve and Woz each 45% of the equity, with Wayne taking the remaining 10%. But Wayne quickly decided he wasn't prepared to risk his future on this pair of neophytes. In June 1976, he sold back his stake for $800 to Jobs and Wozniak, who a year later would commission a new logo. In the tradition of Pete Best of the Beatles, Wayne would miss out on the ride of his life. Shortly after registering Apple as a California business partnership on April Fool's Day, 1976, Steve and Woz made one more trip to the Homebrew Computer Club to show off the finished, fully assembled version of their new computer. Woz had met every challenge. On a circuit board measuring 9 inches by 15.5 inches, he had assembled a microprocessor, some dynamic random access memory chips, a central processing unit, a power supply, and other parts in such a way that once you connected it to a keyboard and a monitor, you could do a couple of radically new things. Write computer programs on your own machine, in your own home, without being tied into a remote mainframe. And for the first time on a microcomputer, you could type your commands on a keyboard and see them immediately displayed on a black-and-white TV monitor, making them easier to edit than ever before. Both steps were radical departures from past practice. Woz had also written a version of BASIC, the simplest and most important hobbyist programming language, to run on the Motorola 6800 microprocessor that functioned as the brains of what he and Steve were starting to call the Apple I. Woz didn't fully appreciate it, but he had created the first truly personal computer. Steve, however, understood the magnitude of the achievement and the power of the term personal computer in the context of an industry that had historically been anything but personal. So that was exactly the term he used whenever people asked him what it was that Woz had dreamed up. The reaction from most club members, however, was tepid. Most were tinkerers, who believed that half the fun of computing was in designing and building their own machines. That's why they called it the Homebrew Computer Club, after all. With an Apple I, however, all you had to do is set it up, connect it to a keyboard and a monitor, plug it in, and turn it on. Others beefed that Steve was flouting the club's community spirit and its history of sharing ideas freely by asking them to pay for a pre-built machine. It was Steve's nature to be out of sync with this kind of groupthink. He was a singular free thinker whose ideas would often run against the conventional wisdom of any community in which he operated. He and the home brewers were cut from different cloth. Their spirited debates often bored him. While a few had broader business ambitions and eventually founded microcomputer companies of their own, most were obsessively focused on electronic intricacies, like determining the most efficient way to link memory chips to microprocessors, or imagining how you might use a cheap computer to play games, like the ones they played on mainframes back in school. Steve liked knowing enough to be conversant about electronics and computer design. And later in his life, he would boast about his own supposed skill as a programmer. But even in 1975, he didn't fundamentally or passionately care about the intricacies of computers in and of themselves. Instead, he was obsessed by what might happen when this powerful technology got into the hands of many, many people. Through the years, Steve would be the beneficiary of a fair amount of luck, some of it outrageously good, and of course, some of it mortally bad. Pixar's Ed Catmull likes to say that since you can't control the luck itself, which is bound to come your way for better and for worse, what matters is your state of preparedness to deal with it. Steve had a kind of hyper-awareness of his surroundings that allowed him to leap at opportunities that presented themselves. So when Paul Terrell, the owner of the Byte Shop computer store in nearby Mountain View, introduced himself to Steve and Woz after the presentation and let them know he was impressed enough to want to talk about doing some business together, Steve knew exactly what to do. The very next day, He borrowed a car and drove over to the bite shop, Terrell's humble little store on El Camino Real, Silicon Valley's main thoroughfare. Terrell surprised him, saying that if the two Steves could deliver 50 fully assembled circuit boards with all the chips soldered into place by a certain date, he would pay them $500 a pop. In other words, 10 times what Steve and Woz had been charging club members for the printed circuit boards alone. Without missing a beat, Steve happily promised delivery. Even though he and Woz had neither the wherewithal to buy the components, nor anything like the factory space or labor force necessary to build anything. From this point forward, Steve's opportunism and drive would define the contours of his relationship with Woz. Woz, who was 5 years older, taught Steve the intrinsic value of great engineering. His accomplishments reinforced Steve's sense that anything was possible when you had technological genius on your side. But it was Steve's ability to manipulate Woz that drove the partnership, and not always for the better. Back in 1974, when Atari had been trying to develop a new version of its big hit, Pong, Nolan Bushnell had asked Jobs to create a prototype, offering a considerable bonus if he could reduce the number of chips required for each circuit board. Steve brought Woz in on the project, promising to split the fee. Woz's design was more economical than Bushnell had thought was even possible, and so Steve was paid a bonus of $5,000 on top of the base $700 fee. According to Woz, Steve only paid him $350, not the $2,850 he should have earned. Walter Isaacson, Steve's official biographer, wrote that Jobs denied shortchanging Woz, but the accusation rings true because it fits with a few other instances in which Steve took shortcuts with people who were close to him. Still, like several other close collaborators who later grew disenchanted with Steve, Woz admits that he would never have succeeded so brilliantly without Steve. Terrell's order for $25,000 worth of computer motherboards was about $25,000 higher than anything Woz imagined he might ever sell. The two young men had created a nice little market for their blue boxes. But that was trivial compared with this. They had never manufactured multiple units of anything at such a significant scale. They had never formally financed a business. Nor had they ever really sold anything of any real value. None of this dissuaded Jobs. He set about taking care of the details of production. For a makeshift factory, he commandeered a bedroom in his parents' house. He roped his adoptive sister Patty into fitting and soldering the semiconductors and other parts into their marked spaces on the circuit board. When Terrell ordered up another 50, Steve moved the operation into his parents' garage after his father cleared out the cars he was fixing up for resale. He hired Bill Fernandez, the very guy who back in high school had first introduced him to Woz, and he brought in other neighborhood kids to accelerate the process. He signed up an answering service and rented a post office box. He did, in other words, whatever it took. The garage became home to an assembly line in miniature. In one area, Steve's sister and some friends soldered chips into place. Woz had his own workspace nearby where he could vet the assembled boards as they were finished. On the other side of the garage, they took turns testing the stuffed boards for hours under heat lamps to verify their durability. Steve's mother answered phone calls. Everyone worked nights and weekends, and Steve was more focused than anyone. He prodded the team ceaselessly. When things went wrong, he moved fast. After an old girlfriend failed to solder a few chips correctly, he made her the team's bookkeeper. His temper was short, and he never hesitated to belittle their work when something went wrong. As a child, Steve had rarely been given any reason to hold back his honest feelings. Now he began to learn one of his first management lessons, namely that his temper, properly targeted, could actually be a very effective motivational tool. It was a lesson that would prove hard to undo. Sure enough, under Steve's gimlet eye, his motley team delivered all the circuit boards Terrell ever ordered. The product didn't exactly fly off the shelf. fewer than 200 Apple I's were ever sold. Even so, that summer, in the legendary garage, represented the first time Steve rallied a group of people to dig down deep and deliver something that was innovative and miraculous, and that they weren't even sure they could create. It wouldn't be the last time he would pull off such a trick. After an aborted stint at college, a picaresque pilgrimage to India, some revelatory travels on LSD, and an internship of sorts at Atari, Steve had discovered his true mission, and now he was totally locked in. Chapter 2. I didn't want to be a businessman. The story of Steve Jobs' first tenure at Apple Computer is the tale of a young visionary in the adolescence of his career. After playing such a crucial role in making and selling the Apple I, Steve faced the challenge of moving his vision, intelligence, intuition, and ferocious personality from his father's garage into a much bigger space, the corporate and financial and industrial world of Silicon Valley. Steve may have been a quick study, but he didn't have an instinctive sense of how to do this. Some young men and women are bred for corporate life. Bill Gates comes to mind. Steve was not. If Steve was ever going to do something grander than just cook up something cool with the kids in the garage, he had to learn to play with the grown-ups. But it wasn't going to be easy. As he told me several times, I didn't want to be a businessman, because all the businessmen I knew I didn't want to be like. Steve's natural inclination was to position himself as the critic, the rebel, the visionary, the lithe and nimble David against the stodgy Goliath of whatever powers might be. Collaborating with the man, to use the colloquial terminology of his day, wasn't just problematic. It was tantamount to collusion. Yes, he wanted to play their game, but by his own rules. Almost as soon as the young men had started selling the first batches of Apple I's, Woz told Steve that he knew he could design a much better machine. As Woz imagined it, the next model would display its results in full color, pack a lot more power and performance onto the same size motherboard, and have multiple slots that could be adapted to help the machine perform more tasks. If Steve and Woz were going to have any chance of producing and selling such a snazzy machine, they would have to scrounge up some serious working capital. They needed far more than they could get by continuing to cadge personal loans from friends, parents, and advance payments from proprietors of hobby shops. Not knowing exactly where he could get that kind of money, Steve began to make a real effort to connect with Silicon Valley's cloistered world of successful entrepreneurs, marketers, and financiers. In 1976, the route to success in Silicon Valley wasn't remotely as well mapped as it is today, when entrepreneurs can find the path to financing by simply Googling venture capital. Back then, the Valley had a much smaller mix of lawyers, financiers, and managers, and most business was conducted face-to-face. But Steve had several qualities that made him a superb networker. I was really lucky to get into computers when it was a very young industry, he once told me. At that point in time, there weren't many degrees offered in computer science. So people in computers were from mathematics, physics, music, zoology, whatever. Wherever they came from, they loved it. And there were some incredibly brilliant people involved. He had no qualms about calling anyone up in search of information or help. Heck, he'd been doing that since his phone call to Bill Hewlett when he was 14 years old. Steve had none of the tentativeness most young men or women might have as they set out to learn the nuances of a complicated new world, like the venture capital business. He had such faith in the excellence of his work that he assumed someone would eventually agree to fund. He could be genuinely charming when this confidence didn't lead him into boorishness. So he tirelessly navigated the Valley's network of experts, one phone call and one meeting at a time, until he finally found himself connected with Regis McKenna, the marketing whiz who had helped promote Intel, and who would eventually be instrumental in establishing Apple's iconoclastic and remarkably resilient public image. Stephen Woz met McKenna at his offices. Steve certainly didn't dress up for this meeting. As usual, his jeans had holes, his hair was unbrushed, he wore no shoes, and he smelled. At this point in his life, he deemed deodorant, footwear, and the like affectations. McKenna was a unique member of the Silicon Valley elite. Well-coiffed, with magnetic blue eyes, he was frank, unforgiving, and ubiquitously networked, and had a sly sense of humor and brash self-confidence that matched Steve's. His business card simply read, Regis McKenna, himself. He saw past the boys' nerdy slovenliness to their remarkable intelligence and found himself liking them. Steve had breadth, McKenna remembers, and a sort of thoughtful way about him that would always be there. So he and Nolan Bushnell, Jobs' old boss at Atari, steered Steve to Don Valentine, a founding partner of Sequoia Capital, one of the first venture capital firms to master the art of early-stage investing in high-tech companies. Valentine came from the chip world. He had worked with the founders of Intel before they abandoned Fairchild Semiconductor to open their own shop, and he had once held a senior position at National Semiconductor. He met with the boys only because McKenna was a friend, and quite literally held his nose to hear Steve and Woz out. After their visit, he called McKenna to ask, Why'd you send me these renegades from the human race? Yet he did point the boys toward an individual angel investor who would be more apt to work closely with an idiosyncratic startup, such as Apple. That's how Steve was introduced to A.C. Mike Markula, who would become, for better and for worse, one of Steve's two primary early mentors at Apple. One day, Markula decided to drive his gold Corvette over to the garage and let the boys walk in through the wonders of the Apple One. A former Intel sales executive who also owned an advanced degree in electrical engineering, he had made a lot of money in a hurry, but had retired in his early 30s when he was passed over for the company's top sales job. Rather quiet, Markula was at heart a computer geek and could do some programming himself. He immediately grasped the potential in the ambitious ideas of Jobs and Wozniak, and he also could see how intelligent, resourceful, and yet malleable they were. After a few meetings, he bought in, driving a pretty hard bargain. In one of the greatest angel investments of all time, Markula ponied up $92,000 out of his own pocket and arranged for a $250,000 line of credit with Bank of America, in return for a one-third stake in Apple. Markula insisted that Woz, who was still working at Hewlett-Packard, become a full-time Apple employee. Woz loved working at HP, but he also really did want to create another great microcomputer. So he made one last presentation to HP to give them a final shot to develop his still-rough concept for the Apple II. They weren't interested. Big, experienced companies and investors, analysts, those kinds of people that are trained in business and much smarter than we were. They didn't think that this was going to be a real big market, Woz remembered. They thought it was going to be a little hobby thing like home robots or ham radios that a few techie people would get into. So he quit his job and signed on. From the start, Markula was an unlikely match for Steve and Woz. A short, trim, dapper guy, he seemed to come straight out of central casting for 70s fashion. With his fast car, long sideburns, full head of hair, and flashy leisure suits. His conversational style could be best described as mumbling. While he was smart and technically adept, he wasn't forceful or combative, nor did he express strong opinions with any passion. And while he had made a lot of money already and was very interested in making more, he really didn't want to work all that hard. Later, after Steve left Apple, Markula would work valiantly to keep Apple afloat. But that was in a crisis. At the point in his life when he met Steve, He was pretty content with his big house and his Intel payout. In a move that clearly reflected his ambivalence, Markkula promised his wife that he would spend no more than 4 years working with Apple. So when Markkula decided that the company should convert its limited partnership into a California corporation and employ a professional chief executive, he made it very clear that he was not interested in that job himself. He recruited Michael Scotty Scott, a 32-year-old manufacturing manager from National Semiconductor, as Apple's first professional president and CEO. Markkula, 34, became chairman of the Apple board. It was February 1977, and Steve, all of 21 years old, had turned Apple over to adult supervision. Unfortunately, neither Markkula nor Scotty could ever become the mentor he needed. The company moved out of Steve's parents' garage and into real offices on Stevens Creek Boulevard in Cupertino. Scotty and Markkula started hiring people and setting up the basics of a corporation. For the first few months, Steve kept doing what he knew how to do best: rally a small crew to produce something wonderful. This time, it was the Apple II, the machine that would really introduce the world to personal computing. Once again, Jobs was the impresario and Woz the engineering genius. Steve pushed Woz, cajoling him, berating him, and challenging his thinking. Woz responded by giving his new machine a versatility and instant usefulness never seen before in a microcomputer. It was the most complete computer in a single, manageable box the world had ever seen. All you really needed to add to it was a TV monitor. The Apple II, its innards housed in a sleek beige plastic case with a built-in keyboard, resembled the consumer-friendly electric typewriters that were popular then. It was designed as a finished product ready for the home, school, or office. The Apple I, it now seemed clear, could be relegated to the world of soldering irons, oscilloscopes, voltmeters, and other electronic arcana that the average consumer never wanted to worry about. The new model had a significantly faster microprocessor than its predecessor, and more built-in memory, which also improved performance. It had an audio amplifier and speaker, and jacks for plugging in a joystick for gameplay, or a cassette tape drive for cheap data storage. Since Woz wanted it to be useful to the hobbyist programmer the minute it was plugged in, he also built the basic programming language right into the system, loading it into a special chip of its own that was hardwired to the motherboard. Perhaps most important, the computer was designed to accommodate unforeseen future hardware modifications that could either soup up its performance or optimize it for a particular kind of computing task, whether crunching numbers, playing games, building searchable lists, or writing programs. Woz built in 8 so-called expansion slots that would allow the insertion of special circuit cards, essentially smaller circuit boards, that could work in concert with the microprocessor and memory chips on the motherboard for particular purposes, such as adding a floppy disk drive, or more advanced video graphics, or better sound, or the expansion of memory. This gave the Apple II the potential to become a much more capable computer once professionally designed software applications and special expansion circuit cards were available for it. And they weren't long in coming. As it had in the garage, Steve's perfectionism and his comfort with being out of sync with conventional wisdom led to conflicts. Steve had opposed adding those expansion slots, for example, because he thought a perfect consumer computer should be so easy to use that no one would ever want to add to the hardware's capabilities by opening it up. The instinct to deliver a computer with the simplicity of an appliance may have been an admirable long-term goal, but it was a profoundly wrong-headed choice for a personal computer in 1977. Business-minded tinkerers had already expressed interest in designing add-in cards that would let the Apple II interact with or control telephones, musical instruments, laboratory instruments, medical devices, office machines, printers, and on and on. Woz understood this and won the argument. But on several other decisions where Steve defied conventional wisdom, he was right. You wouldn't want a truly personal computer to sound like an industrial machine, he reasoned. So he convinced a talented engineer by the name of Frederick Rodney Holt to design a special power supply that didn't heat up so much that it required a noisy, perpetually whirring fan to keep the machine from melting down. Jobs also pushed for an external shell that looked more like an appliance than a piece of lab equipment, going so far as to visit department stores for inspiration. This insight seems obvious now, but at the time, computer hobbyists preferred industrial-looking cases, or even topless machines that showed off the complexity of their insides and allowed for easy modification. For less hardcore consumers, the Apple II's design was more inviting and self-contained and presentable, and those qualities alone made it very different from anything else out there at the time. Even though its first significant software application, VisiCalc, a spreadsheet program written by Dan Bricklin and Robert Frankston, wouldn't arrive until 1979, the $1,295 Apple II was an immediate hit upon its April 1977 introduction. Within 1 year, the company that was accustomed to selling a dozen Apple I's every few weeks was selling 500 or so Apple II's every month. Twice now, Steve had proved himself to be a strong leader of a small group of people. The challenge he faced was to figure out how he himself could be led by Markula and Scott as they set out to do something he knew that he could not possibly manage alone. Design, build, and steer a growing company to develop, manufacture, distribute, and sell computers. Ceding control had not been difficult at all for Wozniak, who had absolutely no interest in overseeing the details of a burgeoning business. A world-class electrical engineer, he always seemed happiest at his workbench, where he could tinker, invent, and debate with his fellow engineers about wonky details as Apple's vice president for research and development. It was far more complicated for Steve, and not just because he had an adolescent problem with authority. He had seen now that his contrarian thinking was essential for the kinds of breakthrough products he wanted to engineer. And he had also seen that his irascible methods could prod a group of people to deliver that vision. Those were qualities that didn't mesh easily with the grown-up leadership that Scotty was trying to bring to Apple. What Scotty offered were systems. If Apple were a family, Scotty would have handled the nuts and bolts of the household, setting up bank accounts, closing on a mortgage, and so on. Of course, what he did for Apple was far more complicated. An engineer with a strong manufacturing background at National Semiconductor, Scotty was a high-tech dweeb, right down to the plastic pocket protector he really did have in his short-sleeved dress shirts. He came to Apple having already managed hundreds of people and overseen the complex fabrication processes at a chipmaker. At Apple, he provided most of the managerial heavy lifting required to build a sophisticated, high-tech company from scratch, leasing office and factory space and equipment, masterminding the design of a reliable manufacturing process, building a sales team, creating quality controls, supervising the engineering, installing management information systems, and putting together an executive staff to handle finance and hiring. He initiated the critical process of developing solid relationships with key component suppliers and software developers. Steve absorbed a lot by watching Scotty handle these tasks. Adding to the complexity of what Scott was trying to manage was the fact that Apple was pioneering a nascent industry that was different from most others in one crucial way. Computers were systems that blended three key underlying technologies that all were in a state of perpetual and rapid change: semiconductors, software, and data storage. A company couldn't simply devise a single, great innovative product, tool up, stamp it out, and then sit back and count the money. That had worked for high-tech companies like Polaroid and Xerox during their first decades. But this was different. As soon as a computer company had breathed life into one new system, it had to buckle down and start all over again in order to outdo itself before some other Promethean company reconfigured newer versions of these ever-improving technologies and stole its fire. And it would have to do so over and over again, generation after